Hello, my name is Tony Gates, Anthony, actually. Anthony Eugene Gates. I was named after my grandfather. That's another story. He had to be in my name or he wasn't going to take my mother to the hospital. And so that's where the Eugene comes from. I am from Michigan, downstate, Hillsdale County, and a town called Litchfield. And I have been in and out of Grand Rapids pretty much all of my adult life.
Welcome to the Discover Montcalm podcast, where we are going to look at the communities, the businesses, the attractions, and the people that make up Montcalm County. Here is your podcast host, Dwayne Weed.
Hello, my name is Dwayne, the host and producer of the Discover Montcalm podcast. And as you heard, we have Tony Gates in the house and somebody that's hiding behind the curtain here. Kara has joined us today. Welcome, Kara.
Well, thanks.
You know, it's nice to have you back in the studio and we get to hear another view.
Where am I? Where
yeah,
where
yeah,
are we?
We
What's
are.
Going on?
Yeah, we brought you back to Howard City today. So welcome back to the studio. And we're going to talk some more about discovering Montcalm. So we're in the end of December at this point. And, you know, we understand that Tony has joined 106.3, the radio station. So I'm gonna have this little discussion start with you.
Sounds like a plan to me. Thanks for having us again, Dwayne. Tony came and got a hold of Jim, wanted to come and play with us with the radio station. So I said, well, why didn't we do this sooner, Jim?
Jim didn't answer me.
He didn't for a while. Yeah. So tell him, Tony, what happened?
I was driving back and forth. I live on the Muskegon River, and I was driving back and forth from Grand Rapids on a regular basis, and I found WGLM quite by accident just because they were playing a song that I couldn't believe they were playing. Their library was deep and varied, and I liked it a lot, and it caught my attention. So I started listening to WGLM, and I sent Jim a note because I'd left after 37 years, the radio station to which I'm probably most known for. And I sent him a note and said, hey, it was more along the lines of if anybody goes on vacation, or I'd love to fill in because I think you've got a very unique radio station here. And I've had my fill of corporate radio. And he didn't really get back to me. So another year went by, maybe a year and a half. And I kept listening to this radio station. And then I sent a note I think it was you, I'm not mistaken, or I found out a contact there. And I said, I listed about 10 songs that I can't believe that they were playing. I remember Hot House Flowers, you know, was one of the songs, Wild Wild West. And they were playing the extended version, which I saw them many years ago in Hollywood in a studio. And they were incredible. And I only heard them on one or two radio stations in the whole United States. But nobody played the extended version, which had a great variation of the song. And when I heard it, I just said, I have to contact these people. So I listed a number of songs and said, I'm very impressed. I don't know much about you, but if there's ever a chance you need somebody to fill in, I'd be more than happy to. And that's how I met her.
All right. Well, let's rewind the story a little bit.
Okay.
Let's go way back. How did you first get into this field of radio?
I got into radio. I came to Grand Valley State Colleges, and I come from a small town, as mentioned. There was 40 of my senior class. I think it's not even 1,000 people. We didn't have a stoplight. We had a flashing light as you went through Litchfield, and it's down around Jackson, you know, not that far from Ted Nugent's house, which I eventually found. And it's in Hillsdale County. And my grandparents, my grandfather was sent home. I left for dead in Paris in World War II, and they put him on a cart with a bunch of other dead people, and he groaned. And they shipped him home, and he bought a farm, a 100-acre farm. And they told him he had like maybe a year to live because he took out a lung and all this other stuff. And he went on, lived for another 20 years. And he was my father figure. He pretty much raised me. And he is the one that's responsible for the patience that I have, which it was not there at all. And he turned me on to hunting and fishing. And I grew up the majority of my life at the farm. But I came to Grand Valley because I liked the size of it I didn't want to go to a huge school. And so what had happened was there was a woman at the time, that I would go over to her apartment, and she was an artist, and she would paint, and she turned me on to staying up late and drinking scotch, and she taught me how to drink scotch, and I love it, and that you, somebody has to do that.
Right, right.
And I always thought I had a chance of getting lucky, but I never did, but that's okay. I really liked her and her paintings, and she would listen to the local, she would listen to the college radio station, which was a 10 watt, and it was one of the, you had to have aluminum foil around a hanger and hang it out your dorm window and get it. And I thought, wow, I'm going to check this place out. And it was in the heart of the center of Grand Valley. Dean Lubbers was there, which was a great guy. And I ended up starting the blues festival there and the jazz festival. And I got a part-time job at the radio station. They didn't pay. But the only shift they had was like, I think, midnight to 4 or something like that. And I thought, well, I'll do that. I don't care because I can take a night off or two, and because it was only 2-3 days a week. And other times I'll go watch her paint. And so I would walk into this huge library, and their studios was actually nicer than most commercial radio stations because of the college funding or whatever. Sure. I don't know how, but it was beautiful. And I didn't know much because I grew up in Litchfield, Michigan, and all we had was CKLW out of Windsor. And they had to play by law a certain percentage of Canadian artists, so Joni Mitchell and Brian Adams and all mm-hmm. those guys. But I didn't know much about Led Zeppelin or the Rolling Stones or any of those bands, and most people in college did. And they were listening to Jimi Hendrix, my roommate was, when I moved in, and I didn't know much about that guy either. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, so I would pull out, and there was no format. It was just, don't shut the radio station off. Leave it and do your thing. Nobody's listening anyway. And I would literally pull out like a J.J. Cale and play a J.J. Cale song. Oh, this is kind of cool, which Eric Clapton recorded a number of his songs. And then I would go I'd go through the seas and I'd find John Coltrane and I'd love Supreme. So I'm self-taught with regard to the music, the wide range of music that I like. But and nobody really found out that I didn't know much about the music. And I ended up getting a full-time shift there. Well, then Grand Valley decided they wanted to attract students based on having concerts. And they had hired somebody to drive the bands from the airport to Allendale, Michigan. And all they did was ask questions and want stuff signed mm-hmm. or whatever. So they fired him, and they were looking for somebody that knew nothing about the bands. And I applied for the job, and I got it. So now I'm driving a limo. And my first person that I picked up was Frank Zappa. And the only thing I asked him is because I saw in the newspapers that he named his child Moon Unit. And I thought that was interesting. And he has to be one of the most intelligent men I've ever met in my life, if not people. And he was so cool. And so he said really good things to me, to Dean Lubbers, about me. And I kept that job. And they, for like 2 or 3 years, because this was my freshman year, through my senior year, they had concerts before they tore that old stadium down and built a new one. And that's how they were attracting attention. And so we saw so many bands, and I picked up so many bands. And I also picked up Walter Cronkite, which is a great story in of itself, because this is the most trusted man in America.
Right.
And that's the way it is. So you might not be old enough, Cara, to remember Walter Cronkite, but that was the news.
Right.
That was the news. And when he was crying when Kennedy was shot and he was doing the moonshot and we watched all of that, that was amazing stuff. And so I picked this guy up. And one of the things that you don't really realize is how blue his eyes were until you met him face to face. And I was just so in awe of this man. And he came to he spoke at the graduation commencement. I wasn't invited to that, but I sat outside and waited for him. And then I took him back to the hotel, which is right off of Plainfield. And they gave me a room next to him because I had to take him to the airport the next day. So I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to invite a friend over. Mm-hmm. And so we were laughing and giggling and whatever, having a good time. And then there's a knock on the door, and I open the door, and it's Walter Cronkite in a robe, a terry cloth robe. And he's got this fruit basket that is huge. And he goes, I thought you kids might enjoy this more than me. And I'll never forget how embarrassed I was and then how elated I was, because he gave us this huge fruit basket with a bottle of champagne. Oh, nice. And so the next day when I took him back to the airport, it took me a minute, but I had the guts to ask him if he would sign that bottle.
Sure.
And he did, and the Walter Cronkite or whatever. And I ended up not getting that bottle. I broke up with that girl, and she came and took her stuff from my apartment, and she took the bottle.
Oh, no.
So somewhere there's an autographed, but it's still, she was a great person. But the diversity of people that I met, it was incredible. And they appreciated the fact that I was asking them genuine questions, and I was wanted, and I wasn't a groupie at the time, or I just respected what they did. So the diversity of those bands, if you go back, you know, and you start looking at the bands that came through Grand Valley in those 4 years that I was there. It was incredible. Actually, five, because I didn't listen to my counselor. I didn't go to a counselor. So I had 120 credits in my major, and you only need 90. It was clinical child psychology, because I wanted to see what happened to me, probably.
Well, you got to figure it out.
So I had to go back and take the fifth year English or whatever. I'm there for the fifth year, and I was so bummed out until my when I realized the first day of class for those courses that I had to take that I didn't. They're all young freshman women, and I'm the only one that has a car. I have a house, you know, and I have money.
It all just kind of worked out.
Oh, my God. It was like, thank you, Jesus. You know? So it was a very unique college experience, and that's when I first met and educated myself on the music, and that's when I first started hanging out with bands and being very comfortable with them and knowing how to treat them like people first, because they're – I've got another story further down the road that is the perfect story to sum it all up in terms of a retrospect with George Harrison.
But at that point, you are starting to, I guess, come into your own.
I was.
Where you're starting to say, okay, I think this, you know, was it at that point that you went, I think I see a career here for myself?
No, I was going to go to Chapel Hill. My mentor was, he was the head of the psychology department, and he really, really helped me. He helped me become grounded because, again, not really a father figure, more of a grandfather figure, mm-hmm. but I still had, I had a lot of potential, but I didn't have any, I didn't know how to harness it or I didn't have any direction. I was all over the place. And we were experimenting at that time with just about everything that anybody handed you. And so it was like, you know, I think that he realized that I had more potential than what I was trying mm-hmm. to put any energy into. And so my plan was, he told me he was going to go to, he said, I'm going to go to Chapel Hill in North Carolina, and I'm going to do a sabbatical, and you want to come and to go to graduate school, and I can get you in. And I said, yeah. So that's where I was going to go. I was going to go to North Carolina and follow this man and become a child psychologist. Well, I had to do an internship in Grand Rapids, and you have to be with the kids and try to help them over, you know, to get them to trust you and talk to you. And that was when I realized, after about 6 months, you also have to tell the parents that they're the reason that their kids are screwed up. And in a nutshell, they don't want to hear that. Parents don't want to hear that. And it's very depressing that you can't help the child that you really wanted to help to. Mm. And so I thought, well, I'm ready to go now. I'll change my – I won't be a clinical child psychologist. I'll just be a psychologist. And so he calls me and he says, how you doing? I said, well, I'm wrapping up this, you know, this job, and I'm coming your way. And he goes, well, I got something else for you. And I said, what? Title IX is a program that funds government projects. Grand Rapids was in the midst of a quandary because they had full-day kindergarten and half-day kindergarten. And the half-day was half as expensive as the full-day. But they had the same test scores. And they were trying to figure out how to measure what they called altruistic growth. And so they contacted the head of the Department of Psychology at Grand Valley and said, we need somebody to help us come up with a design to measure altruistic growth. And he called me and said, we can do this together. I will help you come up with a way to do this. But you're going to have to follow kids in full day and half day kindergarten for 5 years. And I did. Mm-hmm. And they paid me, I mean, really well for whatever I was, 22. And so I ended up with this program. And it was really kind of funny because one of the women that worked in the office invited me to the Christmas party, and I was head over heels over her, and she was something, but she didn't know that I felt that way. And so I thought, well, this is my chance, the Christmas party. Well, she brings Don Newman, who was doing overnights at WLAV at the time, and he was wearing a muumuu and just this, like, you know, kind of bizarre dude. And I'm sitting there going, what's this? She said, this is my boyfriend. And I'm going, he gotta be kidding me. And he's just like pretty full of himself, and we ended up being pretty good friends. But I thought, you know what? Well, I did college radio, and I bet I could, you know. First thing I said to him was, why do you guys play so many commercials? And that's what everybody asks somebody that's in commercial radio, because mm-hmm. they don't understand. That's what funds the whole nine yards, right? And he goes, he just dismissed me and just said, if you think you can do better, kid, you know, take your best shot.
Yeah.
So I was living at a farmhouse in Hudsonville. I was working part-time at that time because I was wrapping up the Title I program, and they offered me a job to continue you know, and do another study for them. And I thought, all my friends are out at the beach. They're all doing stuff. I'm wearing a tie and a jacket. And I did this for 5 years and I'm not going to do it anymore. So I remember I quit and I took a job at Believe in Music as a part-time, and they had just opened a store at Grand Valley. And They had one on Fulton. Well, I ended up managing the Believe in Music in Grand Valley. And I remember calling my dad and telling him, hey, I quit my job. And he goes, really? Okay, well, why? And I told him, and then I told him I was going to go to Jamaica for a month and I was going to come back and work at a record store. And he hung up on me. And so
that was a proud dad moment.
So anyway, the Believe in Music filled that need. At that time, records were $3, I think, and yeah, they would let us open like a half a dozen a week. So I remember the day the first Boston album came in, and it had that cool cover, the guitar cover, and a lot of people didn't recognize that was a flying guitar. And I remember putting it on the store, and we sold every copy we had because nobody had heard anything like that. Nobody had heard anything like what Brad was doing with his foot pedals and his guitar work. And it just fueled my whole thing and about, you know, educating myself about music and being around musicians and doing stuff. And as I mentioned, we started a blues festival. Steve Aldridge was involved. Tim Steele, those guys that worked at LAV, was involved. I met Kevin Matthews. He was involved. There's a guy named M. Dung that was a roommate of two doors down from me. And I remember walking into his dorm room and where's Dung? And his name is Mike, but I don't know how they called him M. Dung, but that's what he called himself. And he said, he's in his closet interviewing his sports coat. And I remember opening the door and he's in his closet interviewing his sports jacket. And I thought, man, this guy is so cool. So I ended up getting him. I remember I put his tape on the desk of Dave Logan, who ended up being a program director at LAV. And he said, I'll never forget. I'll never hire a guy named M. Dung. And like 3 days later, he was on the radio because he just was he was brilliant. We lost him. He's no longer with us. But anyway, I started to surrounding myself with all these people.
The Discover Montcalm podcast is brought to you by WGLM, 106.3 FM,
Business Growth Engine,
West Michigan Technology and Design Solutions, and DW Video.
You know, I mean, working at Grand Valley or whatever. And then I really don't know. Oh, I remember because of Don Newman, I did make a tape at that college radio station, WSRX, and I took it in and I dropped it off at the program director, Ed Buchanan, wouldn't see me at WLAV. He wouldn't see me. And I thought, okay, that's all right. So a sweet, just a really nice young receptionist said, I'll put it on his desk, Mr. Gates. And I'm going, okay. So I walked out of there. It was literally a Friday night. I dropped it off Friday afternoon, and Friday night, it was Saturday night because they did the Saturday night six pack. That's what they did. LAV would play an album all the way through, six in a row, at midnight, and they play it all night. And well, somebody has to turn them over because at that time it was all turntables. And so I get a call. Hey, this is Ed Buchanan. I'm going, oh my gosh, he's listening to my tape. And I said, yeah, yes, sir, Mr. Buchanan. He goes, Ed. And I said, they call me Uncle Buck. And I went, okay. And he goes, you want to be in radio, kid? And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay, when can you start? And I said, I don't know, when you need me. He goes, how about now? Because the guy got drunk on the air, passed out. And at that time, there was no alarms. That it was, the arm was just going at the end of the record.
Right.
Ed had to drive down. It took him 20 minutes to get there, 15 minutes to get there. And he, on a Saturday night, was in no shape to stay there, I'm sure. And so he waited for me to get there. And so he set me down in the chair and he goes, this is what you do.
Here's the buttons.
He showed me. He said, you take the album, you pick it up, you turn it over, you put it down, you put the needle on, you don't touch any of the buttons, and you don't say a thing. That's what I did for 3 weeks, and then I started talking. But, hey, anybody out there? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. We're on the next up, Pink Floyd. Stick around for that.
Yeah.
And he found out about 3 weeks later that I was talking. Then he called me into his office, and I'll never forget, because I only had a Saturday night gig. And he goes, you want to talk on the radio? And I'm going, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, maybe we can work something out and put you on part-time, but quit talking during the Saturday night six-packs. I said, okay. And he eventually hired me. He hired me and gave me my first job. And at that time, on April Fool's Day, he had a woman by the name of Patty Hayes who went on to work in not only XM radio, but she worked in radio in Florida too. But she was our secretary, not the one that I gave the tape to. And he put her on the air as Ed Buchanan on April Fool's Day. And she had this cool, raspy voice. Mm-hmm. Makes me think of you sometimes, Cara. And Patty was so cool. Well, she ended up getting a job. We were kind of a Bill Evans was on the air at WLAV, and some other people worked there. And we would go to, they would go to Chicago because we were kind of the farm club. They would go to the Loop in Chicago. And we all ended up getting jobs at the Loop in Chicago, including me. And so Patty ended up getting a job at the Loop in Chicago. And so they came and said, hey, do you want to do mornings? And I went, God, that's awful early. I'm a kind of a late night guy. And they said, well,
there is such a thing as morning.
I know. Well, Tim Steele really wanted the job really bad. And his whole dream was to be, he wanted to be a game show host. In fact, this is one of the coolest things we ever did at the LAV was at the old Orbit Room. We set up a stage and he hosted a game show. And it was, you would have thought you could, you know, if he fell over dead, it would have been just fine. Because he was so happy.
In his element.
And he wanted it so bad. And so they put him on for a week, and then they said, okay, we're going to put you on for a week. Well, the second day, and I wasn't even trying. I was just telling stories and doing my thing and having a lot of dead air and stuff, you know, because I didn't know how to operate the board properly. And I couldn't keep a single linear thought. I was all over the place. And they came in and said, we want to give the job to you. And I said, you should give it to Tim. No, we're going to give the job to you. And that's how I got hired mornings at WLAV.
Wow. And the rest is history.
Well, 37 years. I was there for 10 years. Yeah. I was there for 10 years. And I left. And I went to work. I was going to go to work at the Loop. But I got a call from Donnie Einer, who was running, he's at CBS now as the president or whatever, but he was running Arista Records for Clive Davis. And I was living in Chicago. I was moving to Chicago to go work at the Loop. Because they were going to hire me. It was not a full-time gig, but something, you know, helping the promotion department at first, right after Disco Demolition. Because Dave Logan, who was the program director at LAV, ended up being, he was at Disco Demolition, and he was the one that started that with Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer. And there's an incredible book out about that, where they actually blew up all these disco records that people brought.
Yep.
And the game, that was a doubleheader, and Ernie Harwell was going, oh, it's terrible because they had to cancel the game, and Michigander should be, you know, or Detroit, and it should be embarrassed, and we were laughing our butts off. But anyway, Donnie Einer called me, and I didn't know who he was, and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm actually at the hospital. My wife's having a baby, my only son. And he said, well, I'd like to interview you. And I'm going, I'm at the hospital. I'm at Northwestern Hospital in the heart of Chicago. And he goes, I'm only in town for a day. I want to interview you. So he came over, and we had a tuna fish sandwich or something from the cafeteria. And he offered me the regional director job of Arista Records. And I said, wow. Why me? And he goes, because we've seen you at these functions. We've talked to people about you, and you've got a skill there where you can talk to artists and you can talk to radio people, and they seem to have fun with you.
And that all started way back at Grand Valley.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, what started as just, you know, you just being you and treating people like people.
With honesty. And,
you know, and not going starstruck.
Right. Well, I didn't know much about them, so I would let them do the majority of the talking instead of people. I got in trouble with the Chicago Tribune because there was Feeder is his name. I forget his, Robert Feeder. He was the entertainment editor for the Chicago Tribune, and he took everything so freaking seriously. And so we did a show where we sponsored the Loop and the Tribune sponsored Paul McCartney. At the Soldier Field, and that's when he was still with Linda. And so there was one person that could go from the Loop radio station to the press conference and ask a question, and they sent me. So they're all asking, everybody's asking, what does this song mean? What does that song mean? What's the interpretation? Did you? And they're asking these 9-page questions or whatever. And I'm sitting there, and the guy is so likable. Paul McCartney is so likable. And you're sitting there kind of feeling bad for the guy, and I'm going, and they go, Tony Gates, WLUP, Chicago. I said, what's your favorite power tool, Paul? And he said, I fancy myself pretty handy with a drill. And he lit up like a Christmas tree. He was so glad that, you know, and I'm thinking, well, Robert Feeder the next day in his column did the whole coverage of the press conference or whatever and just berated me to the nth degree for wasting a question on Paul McCartney. And I'll never forget that night because we're at Soldier Field, we're backstage, there's vegetarian pizza because of Linda and, you know, and we're hanging out and there's a moon that's coming up over Soldier Field. It was magical. It was a magical, magical day, magical night. And this is when he was Wings, right? And I kind of was embarrassed, you know, because it was the next day and this is the concert. And I'm thinking, I made an ass of myself in front of Paul McCartney. What a surprise. And he recognized me, and I'm not used to that, you know. Police, maybe, not Paul.
Yeah,
but
not the band.
I got a great story about the police at Castle Rock.
Yeah,
I got a great story about that. But anyway, so I he starts to walk away, and Linda goes, you know, wait here, and he goes, no, come with me. And so he introduced me to her and said, this is the guy I was telling you about.
Wow.
And then she goes, well, he is pretty handy with this. I asked him to put up a painting just the other day. Mm-hmm. And I have a picture that she took of the Beatles that I got from them.
Oh, wow.
And it's signed by her. And it was right before she died. And I'll never forget that. And I said, well, I must apologize. I said, Paul, I'm so sorry. You know, and this was before he was Sir Paul. It was just like, you know. And he goes, that's okay. It's nice because, you know, he goes, I'm just really a regular guy. And I'm thinking, okay, you go with that, Paul.
Well, but, you know, it's one of those things that everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time. But yet we put them up here because of what they've done. You know, and that's, you know, but I had a memory of you. My son and I have been to a lot of concerts. His first concert was when he was 12. I tried to bring him up right. Bob Seger was his first concert. We've probably seen 40 or 50 concerts together. He's 30, I'm not even going to put it, 32, I think, at this point. But we were walking in down at the ballpark to see Chickenfoot. Mm-hmm. And you were sitting there in the LAV. And we had come over
with Joe Satriani and Sammy.
Yeah. And we were talking with you, just shooting the BS, and you had said you got to check out the opening act, who was Davy Knowles.
Mm-hmm.
And we have since seen Davy probably four or five times, and such a humble young man that, you know. But you were talking him up.
Yeah,
and it was just one of those things that we didn't know that we were going to see him that many more times, but whenever he comes, you know, in Michigan, you know, and we go down, and because, you know, he doesn't know our names, but he recognizes us, you know, because the father son thing, you know, he'll go, oh, how are you guys doing? But that was one of those things that. Just that you were like, hey, you got to check out this young man. So that was kind of fun. I do have a question.
I got to tell you my Bob Seger story.
Yes.
One of my first ones, anyway, because you mentioned Bob, and I love that man. So I was at one of the latter RAF races. I was either the last one or the next to the last one, right? And I just started at this time, and I was just doing my thing. And I remember it was really a short period of time, and I walked out on, and they had it was one of those semi trucks that they just kind of park there, and then they have a metal kind of a roof, right?
Mm-hmm. Over,
you know, and they use it for summer festival and all that stuff. And I get to introduce Bob, you know, and I'd met Punch before, and he was the manager. And Punch went on to manage, you know, well, Kid Rock demanded that Punch be his manager because Kid Rock was such influenced, so influenced by Bob, and that's why he wears those old Foreigner shirts. And Bob Ritchie was a very old school classic rock guy, you know. And so, anyway, Punch goes, listen, just can't, don't be telling any stories, just go out and introduce Bob Seger. I'm going, okay. And so, I'm really skinny then. I was, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I just walked out there, and at that time, they said they estimated there was 100,000 people there for that one. And it was a sea of people. It was a sea of people. And what the city did is they made a mistake because the one before the last one, they had said, there's too many people. We can't handle it. So they said, well, let's open up Riverside Park and let people in, and they can camp overnight, and that'll take care of some of the traffic the day of. Well, that wasn't a very good idea because people stayed up all night and partied, and it was just nuts. And so anyway, I mean there's a picture of the National Guard on the Blue Bridge down there overlooking the river, and literally 100,000 people are there. So I get to introduce Bob Seger. So I go out and on that stage, hi, everybody. My name's Tony Gates and whatever. And they start cheering. And I'm going, oh, man, I haven't been at LAV that long, but I thought, I'm something. I am something. This is, hey, look at me now, Dad. And
hang up on this kid.
Oh, God, it was great. And so I start, you could tell I just switched over to being totally full of myself, right? And Punch is going, you know, let's go. And then so finally, Punch walks out to me and taps me on the shoulder. And he's not a really tall man. And I turn around and he goes, listen, if you don't get that a-hole who's on the roof mooning everybody off the roof, we're not going to go on. And that's what they were all cheering about. It wasn't me.
Oh, my goodness.
The Discover Montcalm podcast is brought to you by WGLM, 106.3 FM, Business Growth Engine, West Michigan Technology and Design Solutions, and DW Video.
But then we had a concert down at the, what is the name of the racetrack in Kalamazoo? I forget, but it's a racetrack in Kalamazoo. And we had a concert there. And we talked Bob into letting us fly alto in a hot air balloon down to the stage. Mm. And it was the opening of Turn the Page.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So he started doing that when he was about 100 feet off the ground. And we came and we dropped him down. And he came up on the stage with a sax. And the place went nuts. So people go, well, you have all these stories, and they don't know whether to believe me or not. But I was at LAV for 37 years. I was there for 10 years. I went to Chicago and worked for Arista Records. And the story of that, after Donnie Einer hired me, he goes, we're going to showcase our artist that her album's done. We're going to put it out in about a month or two, but we're going to rent the Park West, which holds about 300 people. And we're bringing in Handelman, all these music group people that are going to buy albums. And we're bringing in our VIP list. And you're going to be there. And you're the regional director of promotion for Arista Records. Okay. So that meant Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota. I did the regional, whatever that is. And my job was to get things played. And the thing about Arista is, Atlantic that year released 30 albums, and we released 12 Arista. But it was Clive Davis, right? And so he's going to be there too. Be on your best behavior. Okay. Walk in, and my wife at the time just came out of the bathroom and said, I just saw the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. And I'm going, really? Well, that's kind of odd. I said, where? And she goes, there. And she walked out on stage, and it was Whitney Houston.
Oh, wow.
So that was the first artist for Arista that I went out with.
A small artist.
Yeah, on the road.
Yeah.
And watched her, from day one pretty much until then I left, and she was still somewhat of a pure stage, and it wasn't until she met Bobby Brown that she kind of went in a different direction. But Aretha was there because she's an aunt or whatever, and all these mm-hmm. people are there. And I ended up working with Aretha because of Arista Records, and then RCA. I worked for RCA, and I got moved to Los Angeles to be the national director of album promotion. And I did that, and I remember Aretha, she wouldn't fly, and they wanted her to do a video with George Michael. So George says, I'll come to Detroit. This is a true story too. So I'm backstage, and Aretha is there, and I'm Arista is going to record this, right? And so it's a big deal. Well, you're a Michigan guy, you take care of it. And so knock on her door. Yeah, hi honey, I remember you from Whitney. Yeah, I said, anything you need? And she goes, listen, just a minute. And she's in a bathrobe and these big pink slippers, and she hands me $100 bill, and she goes, could you go down to the Burger King and get me as many Whoppers as this will buy? I said, sure. So I go. And I come back, a while later, I don't know. I don't know if they're even warm anymore. And I knock on her door, and I said, do you want me to put these in the green room for the staff or whatever? She goes, no, honey, these are from me.
Wow.
And I just went, okay. Just times like that. I mean, you tell people these stories, they don't believe you. They think you're lying through your teeth. But it all kind of happened, and it all kind of meant to be. And it was all surreal because I think that you hit it on the head. It's like, once the people realize that you're not starstruck, you haven't put them on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. You just hey, what was the last book you read? What are you reading? Or whatever. And then they'll go, hey, you know a place, I don't want to sit in my hotel room. You know a place where I can go shoot some pool or something? And then the next thing you know, that's what you're doing.
Exactly.
And they just really appreciate it. And a lot of them, especially Sammy Hagar, stayed in touch over the years because he was a friend. And still is. I just talked to him not that long ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, but people think that I name drop or I throw these out there because a lot of people that are insecure do stuff like that to make themselves feel better. Mm-hmm. I can't remember half of the people mm-hmm. that I've met, and I didn't keep all the backstage passes or the concert tickets or any of those. But well, basically everybody that I did, that I do remember, was something that I did stupid with them.
Well,
that's where the police story comes in.
But when you think about that kind of stuff, I kind of look at it this way. It's a good thing there wasn't these.
Uh-huh. Oh, amen.
Back then.
Amen.
Because.
But I wish I had to have a lot more pictures.
Well, you would. So I guess it's kind of a good thing. But now you're back in small town radio.
Yeah, I am.
And, there's a lot to be said about community. And you know, you've got all these great stories, but what is something that, you know, obviously you kind of looked for them.
I did.
They didn't come looking for you.
Well, I listed in addition to the 10 artists that they were playing that I never heard anywhere else, like Little Feet and some of these other bands that I was listing, I couldn't believe some of the stuff they were pulling out. And I learned at Arista that I had a pretty good ear. Clive Davis would take us into a room, and he would, at that time it was all cassettes, right? And he would take a cassette, and he would play it. And we had an A&R, Artist and Repertoire, is what A&R stands for.
Oh,
and
I should stop. For those younger people, a cassette was what we used to listen to. I'm sorry.
After the track and
yeah. Well, but they, so wherever we went, they would hand us. I would go in to rent a car, and they'd always ask me two things. Oh, Anthony Gates, are you related to Bill Gates? And I said, if I was related to Bill Gates, I wouldn't be renting a car. I'd be buying a plane, right?
Yeah.
Then the other thing they'd ask me is they would hand me something and say, hey, here's a band. And I'll tell you what, we found a lot of bands that way, you know, and that time. Well, what happened is the industry got bigger and bigger and bigger, and people were – you couldn't vet the bands, whether or not the songs were original or not, well enough, you know, and so whatever. So they started saying, you can't go through our people that way. Mm-hmm. You've got to go through a process, which is like legally, you know, set up so that there's no – we don't sign you and then realize that you've stole these songs or whatever the case. But at the time, people would just hand you – and I remember a number of bands that got signed that way. But Clive – the thing about Clive Davis, this guy was – I mean, if you look at what he – he worked at CBS, and he got in a huge fight with CBS, and they parted ways. And that's when he started Arista. And he didn't like the big labels, but he signed Santana and Bob Dylan. And the list goes on and on and on and on. And so when Clive would have you in a room, and we weren't a really big company in terms of personnel. Because we only released 15, 17 albums a year. But the bands that he signed, he would pick the songs for him. And Whitney and him got into a little bit. She wanted to do certain songs that he didn't want her to do. And so, but you learn that as you go. But he would sit down and he'd say, would you pass on this or not? And he played a demo for us. And he actually at a convention did it where he showed us the ones he passed on. And he passed on Madonna.
Oh,
he did. He didn't particularly warm up to her right away. And he passed on her. He said, I shouldn't have passed on her. But he would play us songs that you had no idea that was the artist that we recorded now, because he would help them transform into, you know, something different or better within their range or whatever. And so it was a fascinating experience. And the other part of that is when I was in Los Angeles as the National Director of Promotion for RCA. That's a big title. The joke that everybody says is you should have been here when I was in the thick of it with the drug, sex, and rock and roll, and it was right when Paola was starting to become investigated by Stone, whatever his name was, on NBC, and people went to jail for that, because if you at that time you had no way. The way that it works now is they have small computers in closet space all around the United States, and they can identify a song within like three bars. You have an app, you can go, what's the name of the song, and then they can identify it. Well, that's how they determined before. It was like, if you got the record played, it was charts, like radio and records. And if it was in a light rotation, you only get one play a night. If it was in medium rotation, it might get two to three. If it was in a heavy rotation, it would get like four to five, like top 40 radio. And that's how we moved records up the charts. And so the whole idea was, our job was not only to get them played, it was to move them up to the top of the charts. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of number one records because we never let go. He hired pit bulls that just never let go. It doesn't matter how you get it done. I don't care how you get it done. Get it done. And we did. We took people to whatever they wanted to do. And I had tickets for the Lakers and the Dodgers. And we could get into Wolfgang Pucks and all that stuff. And I'm from Litchfield, Michigan. You got to remember that. And I'm just always sitting there waiting for the bottom to fall out because I thought I was some kind of a fraud or something. But it turns out we were pretty good at it. But Clive Davis had the talent to be able to listen to a song and hear it down the road, and it was amazing.
He saw the big picture.
He could hear the big picture. He could hear hits, you know. And so I remember we went into we were in Colorado somewhere, and we were doing a convention in Denver, and there was a band that was playing, a local band, and we wanted to check them out. And our A&R guy wasn't there, and he goes, go check this band out. And I said, okay. So two or three of us went, and the word got out that, you know, we were on a guest list from RCA and Arista and all that. And I had a duster. I was in Denver the first time, and I bought one of those dusters. I thought they were so cool.
Very fancy, very fancy.
And the next day, the local paper in Denver interviewed the band about what was it like, and all they did was talk about how stupid I looked in this duster. And you know, this was not our image of an A&R guy, because I don't know, they thought some magical person was going to come in or whatever. And we liked the band, and the band, we passed on the band, but they eventually got signed. But I don't think they had any hits, but it was like one of those things, and I'm thinking, wow, that's what people don't understand, is it's not about, you know, it's just about the ability to have a good ear. And some people have an outstanding ear and other people don't. So if you can hear a hit or you think you can hear a hit, then it makes you a little bit more valuable, especially in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And my thing is, I think I developed it wide enough, and it wasn't jaded. It wasn't somebody shoved one kind of format down my throat, because we would go to the concerts for – there was no metal bands at that point. There were, but they weren't being recognized. But we would go to – wherever there were bands, we would go check them out. Mm-hmm. And I remember later at one point in my career, we were going to raves, and I was the oldest person there, and they would look at me, are you a cop? Are you a narc or whatever?
Did you have that duster on?
And I would go back, no. Yeah. I would go back and say, you know, you need to send somebody younger, because it was me and Billy Gibbons, of all people.
Yeah.
And Billy likes electronic music, and he wanted to go.
Nice.
And so I'll never forget that. And so the thing is, but that makes me, I think, appreciate music of all genres. And when I listen to a radio station and it's taken this whole, the whole AOR, album-oriented radio is what we were, you know, and to play tracks, when the record company guys would come to my studio and they'd smoke pot in the studio if they wanted to, or I got some hash, or okay, hey, well, just, you know, if our owner, because it was locally owned and operated. Mm-hmm. If he walks in, tell him it's a candle, you know, something. So, and we weren't necessarily all, we were just hanging, right? And they would come in literally with a bag over their shoulder, like a Les Nessman kind of a thing, and have records in there. And we would take it and we'd say, I remember the day Billy Joel's album came out, and we're looking for a good song on the Billy Joel, and I stopped on Just the Way You Are. And they're going, oh, this is a wussy song. I'm saying, I think this is a hit. And I couldn't find anything else. And I liked Billy Joel a lot, but it changed so very much. But that's what we did. They would come, they would, the day that we found out that John Lennon was murdered from Howard Cosell on Monday Night Football, we were in a hotel room with a record guy listening to records. I mean, that's what we did. And so it all comes back to, I have such this wide berth of music, and I think I have a pretty good ear. And to hear a radio station, you know, play deeper tracks than this great radio station that we built, 50,000-watt radio station that we built, from playing all these deep tracks and not having any consultants and not having anybody tell us what we had to do.
Right.
And it was just like, try not to play the same songs the guy before you played. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't. And right. Between Ara Sampras and his diverse musical taste, and Doc Donovan and Ed Buchanan, who turned me on to Poco, and all these other bands that I wouldn't normally, you know, the Commander Cody and all these bands. And then me, I was kind of like finding my own bands. And so to have all that music available to you and to limit it to like a 200-song playlist just for the sake because a consultant's telling you. Because when it used to be we would travel, every radio station was different. One of the best radio stations in the United States in Boulder, Colorado. And they didn't change over the years. And they're still considered an alternative station only because they play a wide variety of music. And they were one of the first ones to play our Dave Matthews albums and stuff. And so, but everybody else is following this cookie cutter, you know, and they ruined it. They just ruined it. And they took away the community service laws. Radio stations used to have to do community service. And they had to do every quarter, they had to do a report that shows what you did for the community. Right. They took that away. I saw him doing that, our owner, and I'm going, what are you doing? He goes, well, we still do it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you don't legally have to. And he goes, well, that's not the point. And I went, okay, great. But, you know, it was just, it's horrible. So what it's become, what it's become is horrible. And then corporate radio, you know, saying, hey, we no longer have a need for you over the phone after 37 years of radio. And because I was difficult with a female partner, you know, we don't want that in our, okay, fine. And not being able to say goodbye to my listeners and my sponsors, I missed it a lot.
Right.
But I went away knowing that 37 years on the radio, I'm a dinosaur. It was a long time. Right. And I had a hell of a run.
Mm-hmm.
So when I heard this radio station, I went, you know, this, I do miss it. And if I could just be able to, you know, if they let me play what I want to play within reason, I mean, not just take over the radio station. I try to follow. I played a song today I've never heard. And I'm going, well, that's a new one for me. You know, it's more of a top, I don't know, but I liked it. It was okay. Yeah. But I'm not, but if I, they let me play requests and I can justify these requests that these people are playing and I know who they are.
Sure.
And I'm going, this is a good song. And coming back after being gone for 4 years and not having, and people didn't know whether I had cancer or I died or whether I was in jail or who I shot or who I hit or what I did, but it wouldn't have surprised them, any of those things.
Yeah, so you're not on a work release.
No. And then, so for me, I'm thinking, well, it was me. This was on me. I mean, I'm old and I'm done. And so for me to be able to get in there and I sing, she knows I sing and I whistle and I play requests and I have fun and I'm going, hey, and if somebody requests a song and it's not in the system, she'll upload it or download it, whatever the case may be, and I play it. And it's just really, I like it a lot. And I have the ability to record it because I'm 50 miles away from the radio station, but I want to make sure I'm live the majority of the time there in an incident like.
Yeah, because that was one thing that I asked her. I says, is he recording these, you know, up in his cabin? And she says, no, he comes in as much as he can.
I'm going to try to come in at least 2 days a week, more like 3 days a week. But if I can, excuse me, some days I'm not going to be able to, then I'll make sure that I'll play requests that, you know, from the days or two that I haven't gotten to before. And I'll leave her a note and say, can you plug this in? Because I'm making a long-distance dedication.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's how. Kara, do you have anything that you want to?
Well, I just want to.
Hard to get a word in.
Back to the, like, your music and how you knew one was a hit. Do you get goosebumps when you hear?
Yeah, I really do.
Because I do too.
And you know what? And the people that are closest to me that have lived it, my kids especially, they recognize that I'm probably better at it than they thought.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying, well, he was on the radio, big deal, da-da-da-da, radio's dad. Okay, thanks.
No, it's not.
But especially if somebody's with me, like the plus one is with me, I never wanted to use her name on the radio because I thought it might
tarnish her.
Exactly, that's the word. So I call her the plus one, and we've been together quite a while now. And so she's seen it, and she sees me interact with an artist, and she knows that they generally do remember my name, and they generally tell a story that. Mm-hmm. So because a lot of times you tell these stories, and people think you're so full of crap. And I don't
trust that you remember all this stuff.
I don't remember half of them, but I remember the ones that that had the most meaning to me. I remember I had a tear in my eye the day that Walter Cronkite died. More than one. I remember that. I remember losing Tom Petty would sleep on Sky Daniels' couch in Chicago. And he played his cassette at that time. And when I came back to LAV, I played Tom Petty song on the radio, and the consultant was in town and wrote a letter, which I wish I would have kept because I would have framed it, because they said I should be fired because Tom Petty will never amount to anything. And why is he playing this on the radio?
Mm.
And I'm sitting there going, you haven't got a clue. And so when you run into people like Don Henley, he's not an easy guy to get next to. But I worked with Melissa Etheridge then for 2 years, and I traveled with her a great deal on her first album. And we'd get in a car and we'd go. And she would walk into a radio station, and at that time they would say, hey, we're here and we'd like to play you, we're going to bring you lunch and we'd like to play a song for you in your conference room. And they'd let you in. And I remember two or three or four radio stations that thought, well, we don't have time for it, or no, thank you. And she'd go in and we'd hand out our tuna fish sandwiches or whatever the case, and she'd start playing. And when the first song was Bring Me Some Water, and by the end of her song, there'd be 30 people lined up in the hall watching her. And to see that happen, I met Taylor Swift when she was 16, you know, and I'm sitting there looking at this really pretty young girl just full of vim and vigor, and she could sing, and you're going, holy cow.
And she's got it.
And she goes, I'll be back. And I'll never forget her saying, you'll see me again. And I'm going, okay. Now I've seen too much of you. Thank you very much. Just get married and have babies.
The Discover Montcalm podcast is brought to you by WGLM, 106.3 FM,
Business Growth Engine,
West Michigan Technology and Design Solutions, and DW Video.
I have to tell you a story about the Grammys. people in the music business don't like the Grammys. I mean, it's nice if you win one, all right? Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of politics, and it's a lot of – and what you realize is that the people that are on the board to vote for the Grammys are way too busy to listen to all the stuff. So they'll hand them to their assistants or whatever. So people that are actually voting for the Grammys, they just tell them what to vote for. You know, and it's a lot of it is just like – you know, it's not fun. You know, and in that time, that was everybody was doing drugs in the bathroom, and you had beautiful. I'm from Litchfield, Michigan. I'm sitting there with all these beautiful people in L.A., and I don't belong at the Grammys. I mean, I do, but not really. I should be back at the bar, and that's where generally I was. But I remember that Tom Petty never forgot me because of Sky Daniels in the Loop in Chicago, and we went and saw him at his first concert in Chicago, and he was one of the most boring performers you'll ever meet in your life. He stood there, not a particularly good-looking man, but you know, and he didn't have any charisma coming out of him. He wrote his songs, and it was just like you're going, wow, I like this song, but man, you know. And from what he went from into what he became was just an – it was like a butterfly, like a – you go in the – yeah, it was. It truly was. And so we're at the – it was – I forget the name of the – it was the oldest restaurant – on Hollywood, on Sunset Boulevard, and it was where the number one booth was Frank Sinatra. It was like a steakhouse, right? Red booths with the brass, gold buttons and stuff. And at the after party, Clive Davis always had an after party. I mean, all CBS would have their own, but Clive Davis's was a big one. He wanted to be on that list. And so all of Hollywood is going to be there. But we always had a little gathering before, and we went to this bar, you know. And they would tell stories about playing at the Troubadour where they first got, you know, their first break in L.A. and all this. And they're telling stories, and now here you are in Los Angeles, me, with these guys talking about when they first came. And so it's Tom Petty. So they reserved the number one booth for us. And we're bug out a little bit early because, you know, we had it set up so we're not going to stay till the very end. We're going to go, and we're going to get drinks or whatever. So I walk in, and we're at the number one booth, so it's Tom Petty, and I walk in, he stands up and goes, "Hi, Tone, how you doing?" Come in, with my wife at the time, and I'm going to tell a story that I hope doesn't embarrass her, but it was so heartfelt that night. And so she didn't care about what I did for a living. She didn't care. She wasn't impressed. And that was maybe one of the reasons that I was very attracted to her is because, I mean, she was great, and she's the mother of my children, and we had a lot of really wonderful times. But she didn't go out very often to the bands. So everybody's dressed up. We got limos, and they got, you know, and so it's Dave Logan's wife, Lois, is with us, and she's Carla's guest, and then myself. And then so Tom Petty's sitting there, and he introduces me to Jeff Lynne. "Hi, Jeff. How you doing? Nice to meet you." "Oh, yeah. Traveling Wilburys." "Okay." In walks Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan sits down in our booth. And after that, in walks George Harrison. I'm sitting with George Harrison, wow. Bob Dylan, Jeff Lynne, and Tom Petty, and my wife. We're sitting in the number one booth. Now, it's not very crowded now, right? And I remember getting up and going to the bathroom and trying to come back, and then they put up those red velvet ropes, and I couldn't get to them. They didn't believe I was with them. Yeah. And finally, Tom looked up and goes, hey, let him in. And so we're sitting there. Well, George was the last one to get to the table. And she didn't know who Jeff Lynne was, and I don't think a lot of people would recognize or know him. And the Traveling Wilburys, I really loved Roy Orbison, all right, and then George Harrison always kept ukuleles in his trunk, and he would open them up and give them to people, and he gave one to Tom Petty, and so Tom and George were tight because that was a big deal. George Harrison gave you a ukulele because George loved the ukulele. We're sitting there, George sits down, and so. This is so-and-so, this so. So I'm there, and I'm almost speechless because now I've met them all now. Now I've met them all, right, you know, the Beatles. And Carla says, George, are you in the business? And he goes, yeah, you might say. And Tom was doing his Bob Dylan impression, going, yeah, George, are you in the business? He was, you know, and Bob's sitting right there, you know. And so you're thinking, okay, this is kind of fun. And now they're laughing and having a good time. And she goes, well, have you ever written anything? And Tom would go, yeah, George, you ever written anything? Like Bob Dylan, right? And so I'm sitting there, and I'm turning like 16 shades of, oh, my God, I'm usually the one that is embarrassed. But, you know, she's got such a wonderful heart, and she didn't know. And so he goes, yeah, I've done some stuff. And she goes, would you ever get a song played on the radio? And Tom Petty would go, yeah, George, you ever get a song played on the radio? And
just getting smaller.
Oh, my God. And people are trying to get in to take pictures. And there's George here in this booth, this number one booth. And I'm going, oh, my God. And then she goes, well, could you hum a little something? And Tom goes, yeah, George, could you hum a little something? And I am so,
red.
And so I finally said, honey, this is George Harrison from the Beatles. And she goes, no. And I remember that when we left, that we were leaving because we had to go to Clive Davis's party, mm-hmm. right? And I said, well, I worked there at the time. At the time, I was with RCA, but RCA owned Arista. So okay. We were all invited. And they're all dressed up and ready to go. And she goes, well, they want me to go with them. And I said, what? And I went over to Tom and I said, hey, she's not a, you know, come on. She goes, she is so refreshing. We think she's so great. We're going to go down to some diner and get some Roscoe's Chicken. She's invited. And I'm going, well, I got to go to this party. We'll bring her. Oh, my God. It was so funny. They loved her. George Harrison. And that was one of those moments where you realize that, like, they were so refreshed and so happy to meet somebody that wasn't pretending to like them because they were somebody that wrote a...
Again, down to earth.
Yeah. Because they're all down people, to earth. Too.
And that's what the thing is about Greenville. About one of the things I included in when I wrote the letter to them was not only the songs they played, but, my God, you do a farm report. And I grew up in an agricultural area, and there was a farm report.
Well, that's how we knew you were actually listening.
You play the Star Spangled Banner at 5 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You do the community service stuff. And so when it was asked, well, would you mind doing community service stuff? I said, no, I love doing community service stuff because that's what radio stations should do. They should be a part of their community, and they are. And the guy that owns this radio station didn't do it to be rich or famous because it's a lot of work and it was a small stick. The plus one asked me, she goes, well, you know, is it going to be hard to go from a 50,000-watt radio station to a 3,000-watt? And I said, it doesn't matter anymore because you can stream. You can
stream it, yeah.
Right.
And one of the things that I love about the radio station is they stream the commercials. So if I can help them sell some inventory and I'll do commercials and not charge like I used to get paid to do all the commercials and all that, I will help them do that. And their commercials are getting out beyond. I told Lewandowski's are friends of mine. They own it's a 100-year-old Polish sausage business, and they make their own still from the old recipes or whatever. And they said, you're on the radio? I said, yeah. I said, I'm Greenville. I said, can we get it? And I'm going, yeah, you can get it because you can. Okay, great. And I said, how much are commercials? And I told them, they went, what?
Yeah, you can buy millions of them.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
If I can help them in that regard and give back to the community and show up at Christmas parties or take kids. I took a lot of kids over the years. I took them fishing. And people come up to me now with their kids, the adults, and say, you took me fishing when I was 8 years old and my dad wasn't around or he passed or what.
Right.
And I gave them a little medal at the time that says, you know, you're a winner. It said winner on it. If they caught a bluegill, I had a bluegill medal. If they caught a pike. And they have them hanging on their beds and stuff. And people have cried to me and told me that, you know, what it meant to them to do that. And I did a lot of stuff like that.
Well, it's giving back. Well, Tony, thank you for coming in. Kara,
Were you worried about filling time?
No, I wasn't. We'll be back again.
Yeah, I think I'm going to entitle this Story Time with Tony Gates.
Volume 1. So,
Tales from Tone.
Yeah, Volume 1. So thank you for tuning into this edition of the Discover Mott.com podcast. You can catch us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can catch us on Pandora, Apple Podcast, and iHeart. If you have a story, reach out to me. 231-250-9624. My name's Dwayne, and remember to buy and shop locally.
Amen.